Speaking, a monthly podcast on the spoken word. Episode number 85, February 2025. The World of Puppets, a conversation with Spencer Lott. Hi again, Paul Meyer here. I have some social media news. I'm now on Instagram. Simply search for Paul Meyer Dialect Services. I'd also like to invite you to follow me on X or Twitter at Dialect Paul, and Paul Meyer Dialect Services on Facebook. Lastly, the International Dialects of English Archive is also on X and Facebook, so make sure you also follow those accounts to get all the news from IDEA. I just finished dialect coaching my sixth show for the Florida Studio Theatre in Sarasota. Now running through March 9th, 2025, it's The Cancellation of Lauren Fine. Quoting from the theatre's website, Lauren Fine is at the top of her game. Happily married with a foster son, she is a world-renowned scientist and tenured professor at an elite university. She's on the verge of a breakthrough in her life's work when she runs afoul of the university's diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. Suddenly, her groundbreaking research, her tenure, and even her family are all put in danger. I coached two very talented actors, Freddie Lee Bennett as Chi, a Nigerian, and Anna Miramontes as Paola, a Puerto Rican. If you're in Florida, I highly recommend you attend this production. FloridaStudioTheatre.org. Now, guess that accent. Last time I played this clip from the IDEA archive and challenged you to say where on the planet the speaker grew up.
That gentleman, he is a businessman. He has opened a funeral parlor. He became undertaker. But his wish, he is praying for people to die in the area at least 10 a week, so that he's an honest man working. So as you work, if people are dying and they're buying the caskets and those things, and then he can pay his debts.
What was your guess? It was IDEA's Angola 2. For the full recording and all the documentation, go to Accents and Dialects on the menu tab of dialectsarchive.com, then Africa, then Angola. The sample was contributed by Nadia Barnard. Thanks again, Nadia. The subject was born and raised in Luanda, but moved to Cape Town as an adolescent. Now, this month's challenge. Where did the speaker spend her formative years?
Well, my coworker saw him coming back. She began to run. And when she slid across the floor, it was funny. It was funny. I think that was fun. Hey, girl, what you saying? Maro, I ain't seen you in so long. Hey, I got in the mall now.
What's your guess? Get the answer next time. If you aren't listening to me on paulmeyer.com, switch over now. Select In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services menu tab, then click episode number 85. You'll find lots of details about my guest and other great audio and video links, not available on any other podcast channel. And you can subscribe from any page of the website. For this episode, for the first time, we've added a short video of my conversation with our guest. Access it from the webpage. Welcome, Spencer, to In a Manner of Speaking. Haven't seen you since you were my student in my voice and speech classes 15 years ago. Can you believe that?
Hard to believe. It's so good to see you. It's good to reconnect. What a joy.
Yeah. So we're long overdue on this podcast for a conversation with a puppeteer. Long overdue.
I know your audiences are clamoring for it. I know.
It's an amazing art form. I mean, I've been grappling with it the last few days and getting into the world of puppetry, and it's awakening all kinds of thoughts on my part. So a conversation with a puppeteer is highly appropriate to our theme of the spoken word. Not only making a puppet come to life visually, but vocally. I guess the audiences would know you best from Sesame Street, perhaps. I don't know. How many puppets and puppet voices have you racked up on the show in the 10 years of your involvement?
That's a great question. I've got my main character's name, Sam. He's 7 years old. He's newer on the show. He's introduced maybe 4 or 5 seasons ago. He's kind of my primary character. But the thing I love about Sesame Street is that I get to do a little bit of everything. I I play a head of cabbage named Kyle. I've gotten to do penguins and dogs and roosters and the letter K, all kinds of fun monsters and background characters. And that kind of ensemble vibe is one of my favorite things, is getting to just throw on a background character and have some fun. So many dozens of characters over the 10 years.
You're in your bliss, aren't you?
Yes, indeed. Truly.
You're following your bliss. You're not limited to puppetry, of course. You cross over into voiceover, don't you? Audiobooks, commercials, animation, etc. Yes?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Another niche in our larger acting category. But I do a fair amount of voiceover as well.
Is it the same techniques for all these different genres? What do you think?
They definitely borrow from each other. You know, at the end of the day, it's all acting and it's all trying to interpret the text, tell the story, and being nimble enough or smart enough to know what story you're telling with what tools. Voiceover and puppetry are definitely very similar. Voiceover is very comfortable. You're often standing in a cozy booth with an engineer and having a good time. And puppetry is typically the opposite, or a lot of the television puppetry I do. I'm crammed under a table, I'm stuffed in a sofa, I'm in the back of a car. It's almost never comfortable, because the magic trick is hiding, is keeping yourself hidden from the audience. So you've got to bring all the techniques of voiceover, the performance, the quality, the sustainability, but you've got to do it, you know, stuffed in something. So there's an added physical challenge to puppetry. But yeah, a lot of the techniques and the tips for success are the same.
Yeah, yeah. I've coached people in all of those genres and done it myself. Never done puppetry, however. Actors who must use many different voices in the same show. That's essentially what's going on here. One man or one woman shows. It's quite an art to convincingly portray multiple characters talking to each other, right? What's your approach to that?
Oh, I love that. That's one of the things I love the most. You know, I grew up watching The Muppets, Monty Python, any of these kind of like broad ensemble comedies. I listen to a lot of Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy and old time radio comedies. The magic trick is convincing the audience you're more than one person. You're going from the witch to the prince to the talking rock and back and forth. And the flexibility or the ability to take on those cadences, those rhythms, those tones, you know, quickly and effectively. I love that stuff. And I trained doing one-man shows, you know, when my friends were getting their first jobs, working on a golf course or in a grocery store, I was doing puppet shows. I put together some stories and built puppets and did shows for schools and libraries and the Boy Scouts and whoever would hire me, birthday parties. And it was just the one-man band. So I would do the whole, I would often score it too and do my own sound effects and, you know, opening music and all that stuff. And you're finessing it and making sure that each character is specific enough to be distinct and sustainable enough to do if you're doing two birthday parties in one day, all those good things. So I love that part. The transition between characters and the comedy and crispness of that is hard to beat.
Yeah, I love that. You've done audiobooks with multiple characters?
I have not done like a traditional voiceover audiobook. For Sesame Street, I'll do my character Sam, and then they'll often ask to do, we have a squirrel chittering in the background, can you do the squirrel here? We have a monster playing soccer, a monster boy, can you ad lib some things about soccer? I would love to do like a classic audiobook and be able to nimbly switch. You know, I do that for my daughter, switching back and forth, characters reading at night. And I have friends who are acclaimed voiceover actors in the biz who are very good at keeping all those characters straight over a 300-page novel.
It's amazing, isn't it? Having to convince the audience that there are a studio full of actors, though, not entirely going all the way. At the back of our minds, we know there's one person doing all the voices, but letting the audience be able to suspend their disbelief, see these inanimate objects come to life and talk to each other, it's amazing.
Yeah, that's part of the fun, isn't it? It's that invitation to the audience. If I put my hand out, will you jump? Yeah.
Yeah. I've got one technique that I've heard no one else talk about. And that technique is not to breathe at the speech boundaries, not to breathe as one character ends and the other one replies.
Huh.
It's as close as we can come with a single voice in mimicking the everyday spirit of conversation where we do, in fact, overlap each other. We can't do that as a single voice, but we can come as close as we can to it by not breathing at the speech boundaries. So demonstrating that, I'd say, can I ask you a straight question, Fred?
Sure thing, Joe.
Here's what I'm going to ask you. Breathe there in the middle of the speech. What's the meaning of life? Can you tell me?
I don't know really, Fred.
That's the technique that I've advised my audiobook narrator clients. Try to breathe internally in the speeches and not at the speech boundaries to mimic that thing of overlapping conversation in real life. Have you heard of anyone advocating that particular technique, or do you use it yourself?
I love that. I have found that to be true doing performances, especially, you're carrying the momentum. You're keeping the energy going, right? The ping pong back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put that breath there, then you're giving your audience a second to catch up, right? Which I love that technique. It definitely holds true.
Some of my clients have a lot of difficulty taking that on board. You know, they start a new thought, a new sentence, and that always involves a breath in their minds. So, but once they do get that technique down, they do enormously well. So it's changing character voice on a dime, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's lovely.
So your art has something in common with ventriloquism, right? I mean, do you ever do anything such as Edgar Bergen did with Charlie McCarthy?
I wish I had those skills. I have not trained in ventriloquism. I do know some very talented ones in the larger field of puppetry. Ventriloquism is to puppetry as mime is to acting. You know, it's like a smaller category or niche. And the people who do it are incredible and have trained many years and are very efficient at it. I have not gotten into ventriloquism. One of my early puppets was a ventriloquist doll, a dummy that I think I ordered from a catalog, and it came with a book, and it had all the way, you know, here's how not to move your lips. Talk about breath control and saving your breaths for specific places. Ventriloquism is so much about that illusion and how many words can you sneak in. I'm very impressed by ventriloquists.
Me too. So let's listen to a snippet from Edgar Bergen and Charlie.
Well, Charlie, are you having a good time?
Well, whatever you say, you know, it's up to you. You got your hand up my back.
All right. Well, I would say that you're having a pretty good time.
That's very good, Bergen. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly welcome, I guess, yeah. What do you think of the Smothers Brothers? Do you think they're funny?
Well, I think one of them is pretty funny, yeah, one of them.
Which one is that?
The funny one.
The funny
one,
yeah. You mean Tommy?
I imagine so, yeah. You know, the dummy.
No.
So what do you think when you hear that and see that?
Edgar Bergen's comedy chops are just so good and so refined and so honed. He's signaling to the audience where the laugh is, just like any good comedian. He sets up the joke with a question. He lets Charlie answer it, and then he comes right in with it, and he's laughing at the joke. He's delivered himself, but in another character. But it's in. What do you think about this, Charlie? Oh, I don't like it. Well, yes. And it's just this beautiful, ongoing loop, and he's telegraphing not only where to look at the puppet, but vocally setting it up, which is why it works so well on radio and why the delivery, he could be a two-person comedy duo as a single person.
We talked the other day about the seemingly absurd notion of a ventriloquist succeeding on the radio.
What a time in entertainment when that could be true.
Yeah. Growing up in England, there was a ventriloquist called Peter Brough, and he had a puppet, a dummy called Archie Andrews. Mm. This, I'm talking about a pre-television era. My first encounter with him was on the radio. I guess he established himself on stage first, but the transfer to radio was magical and terrific.
It was so much of the time, you know, even Mel Blanc, like listening to old Jack Benny shows and Phil Harris shows, and any time that Mel Blanc would have guest spots on there, Mel Blanc would do 3, 4, 5, 6 different characters in one show. All those skills and all those vocal skills he'd built up, I'm assuming in theater, in, you know, I don't know if he came specifically from the vaudeville era, to then transfer into radio, and then, of course, to become the voice of all of the Looney Tunes. So fun. Yeah.
Terrific. So this might be a good time for me to ask you something that Cameron, our co-producer, wanted me to ask. It's about the mystery of imbuing an inanimate object, a puppet, with life, taking on the puppet's identity, or the puppet taking on some part of your identity. It's kind of mysterious and can be quite scary. You know, I'm thinking of those movies where the ventriloquist dummy comes to life, often malevolently. Do you think about that magical, mysterious aspect of puppetry? I'm sure you do.
Yeah, it's such a balance of both, right? Because I understand the technical components of what makes it happen. Just like any performance, it's stillness, breath, focus. Those are the things that you can very mathematically create a performance that will elicit a reaction. But then there is this magic. There is this kind of undefined element to it where it's an invitation to the audience. As humans, we go around the world looking for examples of ourselves. Any two circles on the side of a building, and we've anthropomorphized that building. That building now has a personality and feelings and intentions. And yeah. And so we go through the world like this. We're wired for this. Yeah. And so even a rudimentary puppet, even a puppet without a moving mouth or you know, with barely any eyes or all kinds of different scales, we want to believe. We will make that jump so quickly. It's a superpower. You can distract your audience malevolently or benevolently for whatever purposes you need. Mm-hmm. You can distract them to say, hey, look over here, look at this thing, it's not me, even without being a ventriloquist. I don't even need to worry about my mouth, because if I do it right, that everyone's looking at the character to begin with. Yeah, there is a magic there.
I'm glad you made that point about focus, not necessarily needing to have your mouth completely still. That's really evident in the next clip I'm going to play. One of my favorites is Robert with traffic cop Timmy from Everybody Loves Raymond. Let's listen.
Hey, Frank, why don't you park it over there? And I mean legally. That's quite enough out of you. Now, why don't you sit down, big nose? Yeah, remind me to never drive with you, you crazy old bastard.
I'm going to put that video clip on the website along with this, so you'll be able to see as well as listen. But Robert, you know, his mouth is still moving, but because he's made us look at traffic cop Timmy, we don't look at him and don't see that his mouth is moving. What do you think?
That's exactly right. And his posture, right? He's throwing attention just like you would on stage, just a tiny little movement. Oh, you know, look at the puppet saying the line, and then he comes back. It's all those little cues that we are reading all day long in our real life and how we use them to direct attention, just like a magician would. That's such a good example of the fact that puppets can do and say things that we cannot.
Robert was not breathing between speeches there. I mean, it was a wonderful flow between him and the puppet.
I'd be curious to see if he's actually Brad Garrett, right? Was he trained as a puppeteer? I wonder if they had another puppeteer there with him. I wonder if there was a professional puppeteer helping him out with that performance, or if he was doing that himself. It'd be interesting to.
I'm fairly sure from the visuals that he was operating the puppet for sure. Is that what you meant?
Yeah. That was my question. He's a smart actor. He nailed it.
And how good with voices is he, huh?
He's great. And so much of it is the delivery, right? How he's setting it up, and he's waiting for that laugh, and knowing, signaling us it's okay to laugh here. Here's the funny. Yeah, it's great.
Brilliant. Just a thing to the listener. Remember that the full clips of what you're hearing, along with lots of other information related to this topic, lots of Spencer's own work, can be found on the podcast page at paulmeyer.com. So we've talked about analyzing the text to craft a puppet performance, finding the lows and the highs in the scene, finding the beats. I think the listeners will be surprised to learn that the same techniques for a play or a film apply to puppet work also.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's what are the tools? You know, puppetry is one of the beautiful things is that it's simplified, it's limited. Our faces have hundreds and thousands of micro expressions and muscles that are working and firing all the time to help us tell the story. And puppets do not. They're made out of wood or cloth and often very simplified. And so...
And yet they're full of life.
That's right. So when you receive that text, when you see that script as an actor, as a puppeteer, you're not only scoring it for tones and highs and lows and breaths and you know, intentional and stuff, but you've got the reality of the puppet, of the object, the doll that you've got to wiggle through the scene. You kind of have to approach it with a director's eye and know that, oh, we can't actually, you know, the script will say the puppet stands up from the table, picks up a pencil and walks out the door. You know, as an actor, great. We can shoot that in one take and move on. A puppet, that might take four different shots and four different setups and specialty, you know, specialty rigs and things like that. So if that's true, if you've got to be able to break up this line or this moment over four different shots, how do you keep the energy and the intention and the vocal performance consistent? Mm. So you're setting yourself up. I'll say this part of the line here as I exit frame, because I know we're going to have to cut to the other side to continue the thought. So it's all those little technical things.
That's a challenge for continuity, isn't it? Sort of remembering the tempo and the pressure that you had in the first frame and bringing that back when you come back from the other angle.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
How do you make your choices, your vocal choices for a new character?
That is a great question. I feel like I'm taking in all of the inputs. You're trying to match the tone of the piece, wherever it is. So often with puppets, we get to play broad, and that's where I love to play, but not always. And when you can do a puppet performance that's still and quiet, those are sometimes the most impactful. But so you're taking in the tone of the piece, you're taking in the material and the audience. So often we're asked to think about our audience. When, you know, at Sesame Street, our audience is young people. And kids. And so we've got to keep that in mind. The way that we deliver a line to a 5-year-old is different than a 35-year-old. And so the trick is to keep it.
Without condescending. Without condescending.
Exactly right.
To the kid.
We're always trying to aim high, right? We're always trying to make sure that that kid has somewhere to look up to and that it's not condescending. It's not belittling. And it's a challenge. And it's a challenge, especially with educational content. And then I have like my roster of voices, but then it's also looking at my ensemble. Where do I fit?
Yeah, that was my next question. How do you find your note in the symphony exactly?
I've gotten to train under and watch a lot of the best puppeteers and Muppet and Sesame Street performers over the last 10, 20 years. You know, we do have a natural place. I'm this like tenor. I have this high squeaky voice. It's very youthful. I am not, as much as I would love to be, a deep, strong baritone or bass. That's just not where I live. But I'm aware of that. I think when I was a younger actor, I thought, no, I can play anything. And now I'm much wiser. It's like, oh, no, my take on this is going to be a higher, squeakier version. And I'm going to do it well. And you'll forget that you even wanted a bass to read this part before. There's nothing better than when you get cast as a boulder or a mountain, then playing the opposite and doing the high squeaky voice is such a nice juxtaposition. And puppets allow that. You know, it's not me on camera. As me, I'm this skinny, bald guy with glasses, and there's only so much my audience will allow me to inhabit. But with puppets, I can be an apple, I can be a xylophone, I can be the letter K, I can do all these things and bring some energy to it, yeah.
And the lovely thing is, as you said before, you can rely on a natural tendency to anthropomorphize things. I mean, it's just a little sock puppet, kind of incapable of a vast range of expressions, but we will provide them in our mind, won't we? The audience, we will imbue what you gave us. You gave us the right to see more than you've actually able to project.
So much of it is that invitation. You know, when you watch a magic trick, you are invited to challenge it, challenge your reality. You're looking for the holes. You're trying to figure out how it's done or trying to prove them wrong. And puppetry is the opposite. It's an invitation. It's how little can we do to get the audience to invest in this life. Just like with a good piece of text, you know, it's a breath. It's a sigh. It's a glance. It's just focusing on these little things and playing it as authentic and truthful as you can. It's especially dynamic when it is just a sock. There's nothing more heart-wrenching than a sock who just can't get their act together. It kind of strips away the artifice and it taps into that emotional core of the character.
It's magic. Kermit and Cookie Monster are delightful together, aren't they? Let's play a little bit of Kermit and Cookie Monster, and then I'll get you to comment on how that magic is achieved.
You see, if anybody can guess from the clues I give what is in this box, then they can keep what is in the box.
Is it cookie?
No, it is not a cookie.
Bye-bye.
Oh, but wait a second, Cookie Monster.
Wah.
There are clues.
Well, who care about clues without cookie? Me want cookie. Huh, no cookie, no guessing game from clues. Arrivederci, Frog.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. And it's two characters that we don't get, you know, we didn't get to see often enough. You know, Cookie, obviously it's Jim Henson and Frank Oz doing this, and they've got, you know, a decade's worth of this comedic duo. They've got all this timing and this energy. And, you know, your point of breathing in the middle of the line or allowing the next character to go on without those pauses. This is such a great example of that. You know, in a scene that could drag because you've got a character leaving frame every, you know, 7 seconds. But boy, Jim and Kermit are just setting him right up there. Oh, yeah. Cookie Monsters, they're just keeping, we call it, you know, you're keeping the balloon in the air. We're at Sesame Street, we'll talk about tumble. Let's do this scene again, but it needs to tumble. We need to be anticipating our cues and picking up those cues so that it just feels like one thing happening and not in each individual line being said. It's so good.
Yeah, I like to talk about achieving takeoff velocity in a scene, like a plane leaving the runway. The scene mustn't keep lumbering down the runway. It's got to take off at some time and sustain that velocity to keep it elevated somehow.
Yes, I love that.
And I couldn't help noticing when I was hearing that again, they're speaking very fast, but very clearly. Their diction is amazing.
It's quite good. even for a grovelly, you know, for a Cookie Monster type, wah, 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 like that is not easy.
Yeah, Cookie Monster could easily devolve into just, rawr, you know, that kind of indeterminate, unspecified energy that we often hear, unfortunately, in children's theaters.
Definitely. They're technical wizards. These two were very proficient, not only with their performance chops, but their technical chops in delivering that message to the audience. They knew what it needed. And I guarantee the script had half of that. The script was, you know, Cookie is going in this box and he's suggesting things. And the two of them looked at it and started upping it and started amplifying it and finding their own way to keep that airplane in the air, even for something as simple as guessing what's inside the cookie jar.
Are they off book? Is this dialogue typically memorized?
That's a great question. It depends on the day. In its heyday, Sesame Street was shooting over 100 episodes a year. So they'd be burning through an episode a day. And as an actor, it was nearly impossible to keep up with that. And because they're looking at monitors, you know, this kind of television puppetry, we watch the monitor in real time. And so we're seeing exactly what you at home are seeing, the framing of it, the lighting, the shadows, the props, everything we're seeing right there with you. And so we will, at Sesame, we'll tape our scripts, we'll fold them up in this specific way and tape them along the monitors so we can go back and forth. So when the writer says, you know what, you can't say moose, you need to say bear cub or whatever it is, we're there and we're marking up our scripts in real time and then ping-ponging. And sometimes you can tell. Sometimes it sounds like we're reading our lines, but the real art form is having the script there for reference when you need to burn through material, especially educational material where the word choice is incredibly specific and has been researched and needs to be delivered in a very specific way. But then, you know, Jim and Frank were notorious for finding their way in and out of those things and knowing they knew their characters so well. They had so much trust with the directors that they could have some fun.
Reminded me of what's common with all of the art forms where an actor is having to read a text, speech making from a teleprompter. The art is to lift it off the page, of course. You'd never suspect that Cookie and Kermit were reading a script or had a script taped to their monitor. They succeeded beautifully in lifting it off the page and rebirthing it in the moment.
It's a great example of that.
So, audience at home, the whole clip is on my website. Yeah, you said earlier, Spencer, that as a puppeteer, you spend a long time stuffed under a table or under a couch or whatever. That's got to be vocally challenging and physically challenging.
Yes, as performers, it really helps to stay limber. Limber vocally, limber physically, because what we're being asked to do is a little bit above and beyond what a typical actor might have to deal with.
Yeah. I've seen behind-the-scenes shots of some of Jim Henson's works, and he's under a simulated lake. And
yes, he's under, in a tank in a lake.
He's in a tank and under, under tremendous, he's physically distorted to, and he's got to keep doing that take after take after take. So the athleticism that's involved is quite remarkable, isn't it?
You have to find a way to make it sustainable. The physical act of holding the object above your head, and every puppet's different and has its own challenges and forces your body into different, contortions or ways of moving through the set. And then vocally, you have to do the same. If you're cast as Cookie Monster, you've got to sound as good at 4 p.m. after lunch as you did when cameras started rolling at 9 a.m. And the performers, Cookie and the performer who does Cookie Monster now, David Runman, Ryan Dillon, who plays Elmo now on the show, the performers talk about building up the chops, building up the, they call it scar tissue, but it's building up the physical capabilities to be able to sustain that over one day of shooting. And then you're shooting Monday through Friday, and then you're back in the studio the next week, that kind of thing. So it's demanding for sure.
Hmm. And at all times, you've got to hide the effort, make it seem effortless, right?
That's it. We don't want to hear you sweat it. We want to believe that you're worried about us, not you.
That's it. Switching gears rather abruptly here, how much do we know about the art of puppetry going back to antiquity?
Anytime you'll get a puppetry book, one of the puppetry tomes over the last 100 years, they'll always have a foreword, and it will always mention the cave. Puppetry dates back to the cave people. And in the shadows of the campfire, they would tell stories. And they would take a rock and a twig, and they would animate on the cave wall in a shadow puppet form where to find the right berries, where to hunt, where to follow the deer, where we should be farming next, those kind of things. And so as puppeteers, we always live with this. It's a kind of very natural progression of storytelling mm-hmm. and of communication, speech. And then we start getting into, visual art and all the incredible cave paintings that we've discovered around the world.
Yeah.
And that surely animating objects, building art objects, animating them, using them for demonstration, for communication, must have been very close thereafter. I think it's got a long history.
Long history. I was sure that was going to be something like your answer. Yeah. You coached Tom Hanks for the Fred Rogers biopic, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, right?
I did. I had the privilege of working with Tom. My little company recreated the puppets for the film, trying to match exactly what they looked like on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And so then, Tom was playing Fred Rogers and wanted some coaching for the puppetry. And so I got that job. It was incredible.
I'm sure it was. I'm sure. And a lot of fun, I'm sure.
He's the real deal. He's smart. He's generous. He's prepared. He knows himself and what audiences and directors are expecting of him. He knows that this is the Tom Hanks version of that character. He was lovely to work. He was much more interested in me and kind of my craft and how I got there than he was in the techniques of puppetry. He wasn't worried about that. He's like, oh, he'd figure it out. But he was genuinely interested in me and how I got there and the kind of my career as a puppeteer. And he was great. So in the movie, anytime you see him as Fred puppeteering, that's really him puppeteering in the film. And then whenever it's a close up and you just see the puppet, it's usually me. He would tap me in for those close ups.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. And we'd finish, he's there stuffed. He's living the life of a puppeteer, very glamorous. He's stuffed in King Friday's castle and reaching up and trying to deliver the performance while looking at a monitor. And he'd finish a take and Mario Heller, the incredible director, would be like, Tom, how did that feel? Did you feel good about that? And Tom would say, yeah, I'm good. If Spencer's the only one who knows what it's supposed to look like, if Spencer's happy, I'm happy. Let's move on. It was a joy. What a privilege.
What a wonderful gig. Let's have a scene from the film. I love this scene where Mr. Rogers introduces his special friends, the puppets, to the journalist interviewing him. I'm sure you remember the shooting of that scene.
This was one of the first scenes that I was there for. And so this was a very exciting moment for me as well as he opens the suitcase. It was the first time that we were going to see the characters as we recreated. Yeah, it was a lovely scene.
You wanted to meet my special friends from the neighborhood of make-believe.
No, I asked you about the burden you carry.
I am King Friday the 13th, sir. Lloyd Vogel, the journalist, I presume. And here's Daniel Striped Tiger. Now, sometimes Daniel is too shy to talk, but that's okay, Daniel. Have you met Daniel?
Not officially, no.
I'd like to meet Old Rabbit.
I don't want to talk about Old Rabbit, I gotta say.
Well, maybe Lloyd doesn't feel like talking today, Daniel. And that's okay.
That's so moving, isn't it?
It's really lovely, and it speaks to the power of puppets, right? This magic, it can be used as a teaching tool. It can be used as a therapy tool. You know, it's a level of separation. It's a mask. It's a barrier. It's an opening so that if someone, you know, two people face to face, you know, Lloyd is clearly it makes him very uncomfortable.
And yet he succeeds as a therapist tool of letting him go to his darker memories and be uncomfortable with it and have those memories stirred just by a little sock puppet, right?
That's all it takes. And then he has to actively pull himself out and be like, I'm not focused on that. I'm not believing in that. Yeah. A little goes a long way.
Tom Hanks certainly understood that understatement was very effective.
Stillness. Yeah. Stillness. That's so much of what we do on TV, on stage. When I work with actors or dancers, a huge part of the coaching process is just doing less, trusting the object and just being still so that then when you do move, it's a choice. It's a specific moment that can highlight, you know, and these are all things I'm sure I've gotten from you, Paul, from being in your classes.
That's kind.
That stillness is so important. It's your baseline for everything else.
There's not enough value placed on stillness and silence.
I couldn't agree more.
It seems that there is a tradition in puppet voices of exaggeration, over-the-top voice characterization, and we love it. But some puppeteers lose the nuance and subtlety in that. But then I think of Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, one of my favorites. Lots of subtle, realistic, nuanced performances side by side with the comic exaggeration of some other characters. What's your take on this? It seems to me it's the same in children's theater sometimes, as though the kids don't deserve the same level of sophistication as adults do.
You're spot on. So much of it is the tone for me. It's the tone of the story. Emmett Otter's a lovely example because there's moments in that story where it's just the two of them on the rowboat talking about their life's problems. It's very still. The puppets themselves are working with the storytelling, not against it. The puppets are small and flexible, and they're able to do some really nice, small, intimate manipulation. And then you cut to the next scene, and it's a River Bottom Band, and it's over the top, and it's, you know, very broad and comic.
Here's a little clip from Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas.
Love can open your eyes.
Welcome, brother, to our world.
That's fine music, folks. I thought you needed something a little extra, but it appears to me that what you needed was each other.
Well, we're mighty honored you liked it.
You wouldn't consider working at the Riverside Rest, would you?
Wow!
Wait a minute. Is the pay regular when we play regular?
Sure is. And meals are on the house.
Isn't that lovely?
So charming, so nostalgic. It's great. This one is so successful because all of the departments felt like they were on the same page, right? Textiles and the costumes and the materials, the scale, the type of story they're telling, the Paul Williams score. It just works. They've built this whole world and it's easy to want to go there.
Amazing. Are there a lot of puppet artists producing work for grown-ups? It seems to me that puppetry is associated with children exclusively.
And that's very common in America because of things like Sesame Street and even before Sesame, Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, and you know the Howdy Doody, the puppetry was being used for kids. And so there's generations of Americans who have pigeonholed it, have put it in that box. But of course, like any art form, there's brilliant puppetry that is sophisticated and dark and eerie and specifically for adults. There's shows running in Under the Radar right now, the incredible theater festival in New York, Under the Radar, that does groundbreaking in avant-garde work. There's two shows specifically for adults. The American puppeteers are jealous of the European puppeteers because it feels like European audiences are much more likely to support an adult-focused show than our audiences. And the same goes for TV. When we're pitching TV shows to producers or to networks, producers are nervous. And this is something that Henson ran into. They think the puppets are for kids. And so trying to convince them otherwise can be a hard sell.
Yeah. Puppets have often been a tool of artists who are regime critics. Sometimes the puppeteer plays it safe and straight, a perfectly obedient citizen, leaving it to the puppet to level the political criticisms. I'm thinking of Bread and Puppet Theatre and that subversive character Punch of Punch and Judy fame. He got started in revolutionary 17th century England and is still going strong. And kids love his subversive antisocial behavior. Thoughts on that aspect of puppetry as a tool of political commentary?
It just speaks to that magic. Puppets can do and say things that we cannot. So speaking truth to power, saying things that are uncomfortable or saying things that would otherwise be persecuted. You know, what are you going to do? You're going to arrest the puppet? You're going to arrest, take Mr. Punch off in handcuffs? A good puppet will often symbolize an entire idea in a single entity, right? So the Bread and Puppet is so good at taking these large concepts, private prisons, food insecurity, these things, and symbolizing it into spirits, animals, you name it.
Yeah, amazing. What a powerful art form. Interesting. So you have a daughter now, yes?
I do. I have a 5-year-old.
What's her name?
Her name is Hazel.
Hazel. I envy Hazel and her bedtime stories from her dad.
She is amazing. She thinks that everyone works in a puppet studio. She has no clue that there are dentists and bankers and tech people. She's just like, nope, everybody goes to work and they make puppets. She got to come to set. She got to come to Sesame Street this past year. And it was just a full circle moment to see her. She's in Oscar's trash can. She's in Big Bird's nest. And to see her experience this place that I, you know, that I grew up watching and wanting to be a part of and now get to be a tiny part of. She's a lucky kid for sure.
To close the show, you're going to do something, perhaps something that you might do for Hazel. All right, Mr. Spencer Lott, it's showtime.
Okay, let me see what I can do for you.
There you are in your garage workshop. Tell us about whom we're going to meet here.
So this is Fancy Duck. This was my It's a sock puppet. It's very rudimentary. It's very flexible. It's got this soft, squishy bill, so I can do all kinds of great little just with the tilt of a hand, you know. And then of course, and the fabulousness of, you know, this is totally stolen from like a Miss Piggy, you know. This
yes, that's a Miss Piggy thing.
It's such a Miss Piggy. Life is so hard, even when you're a fancy duck like me. Sometimes I go to the park and people throw breadcrumbs at my feet. And I think, how dare you? You know, and this character, we talked about all of my characters are these squeaky characters. And that's often what I'm tasked to do. And so I wanted to try something that was a different cadence and very breathy and low and still and quiet. And so that's what this character is, just an excuse to be, to get to say things that I can't say and be obnoxious and egotistical and selfish and all the things that are so fun to do, but through this ugly duck puppet. And I think it's just so, this duck is just totally obsessed with itself and thinks this duck is God's gift to humanity. And it's just not.
I predict a great future in the performing arts for your duck. Well, thank you, duck. Hey. And thank you, Spencer. Congratulations on your huge success. And thanks for talking to your old professor today.
Oh, Paul, what a pleasure and a joy. I always loved being in your classes. Myself and my peers thought the world of you. We think the world of you. You, the rigor and the attention and the expectation that you brought just to your everyday class, a Wednesday morning at 9 a.m., I knew that I had to be engaged and on my game because you expected nothing less. And I'm so grateful and so excited to be able to talk to you about this. And thank you. I'm a fan of the podcast and can't wait to hear your future episodes.
And thanks to you for joining me, Paul Meyer, and my guest, Spencer Lott. For full information about him and his work, go to paulmeyer.com, choose In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services tab on the menu bar, and click episode number 85. There, you'll also be able to watch a short video of Spencer's conversation with Fancy Duck. Don't forget to follow Paul Meyer Dialect Services on Facebook and Instagram, and me on X or Twitter at @DialectPaul. Email me with your comments and questions, paul@paulmeyer.com. The audio clips in this episode were all used by permission or taken from YouTube and used under the copyright doctrine of fair use. Details on the podcast webpage. Next month, my guest is James Still, our first playwright guest. He's a 4-time Pulitzer nominee and author of nearly 30 other award-winning plays. James and I will be talking about how playwrights create distinctive voices on the page for their characters. Next time on In a Manner of Speaking.